proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wild Boars most. Venison packed, antler racked, bullet impacted, title hacked, character jacked, pain racked, ransacked, foundation cracked, contract enacted, least compacted, fact backed, second acted, after pacted work. Huzzah!
Huzzah!
As it releases. Top that. I'm Elliot Diebold.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
What the fuck happened to this intro? This has really spiraled out of control.
I actually changed it. It did say I'm Ruben Morehouse, and then I changed it back to because I don't know if you listened to the episodes, but I kept getting my name wrong during the intro.
Right.
So I thought I'd see if I could get you to Ron Burgundy out my name, and it worked like a charm.
Yeah. Anyway, we're coming to you live in the Discord.
Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas, everybody.
Essentially.
Well, yeah, you know, in this fine country of ours. I was going to say great, but I downgraded it to fine. we have a special Christmas tradition called Boxing Day, and that's what it is for us right now. But I think it's Christmas for most of those folks in the world.
Yeah, and we're on a perfect, like, this has been a great streak in December, because I realized our first December episode was my birthday. The second one was when we had Jenny on, and it was her birthday.
Mm.
Then last week was Deep Impact's fourth birthday, and now obviously it's Santa's birthday in most of the world as we're recording this.
And then next episode will be the year's birthday.
Yeah. So, yeah, we're on a sixth straight.
We're killing it. We're here to talk about Pale, which is a story, if you don't know, written by a guy called Wild Bo. He posts it online. And if you didn't know that, this
sorry,
is probably
Ruben,
not
I mean,
the right...
Look, welcome back, Ruben. You haven't been gone that long. I don't know that this is necessary.
I just wanted to make sure, you know, because I've been away. I don't know, like, what's happened. I know episodes with Jenny or Malia can get it a little bit off the rails, so I just kind of want to, you know, put it all out there, like, go back to basics.
The other thing you obviously would have seen is there was the sword moot last week.
Mm-hmm.
The tweet is out there with the official rules, even with some typos in there, because proofreading's for suckers.
Yeah, that's one of the rules, isn't it?
it'll definitely be in the next moot. So those are legally binding for me and Ruben. We haven't exactly determined what the punishment is, but you can track and gainsay us if we break them.
Yeah. Anyway, should we get into the chapters?
Yeah,
we're here to talk about Hard Lucy Pass. Week. Yeah, two Lucy chapters. Lucy is back home with her mum, but still no news of Avery. Still no Avery chapters this week. And yeah.
I love that. I mean, that summary actually just works as a summary for both these chapters. Like, the whole week as a whole is Lucy is quote unquote home and there's no news of Avery. That basically we can pack it up and go home. That kind of covers it.
Yeah, so as we do each week, we pull out some predictions from our community. So, I mean, I'm sure you've talked about this already, but yeah, like, this arc looks like it's going to be Avery-less. Very bold move from Wild Bo.
Yeah, I still wasn't sure at the end of last week. I think this week really cements that we should be, like, buckling in for, when in arc 10... when Verona was essentially gone for a whole arc, that sort of feels like we're doing something similar here at this point. The concept of how big an arc is very different to what it was in arc 10 though. So it may not end up being a whole arc again, but we'll see. I mean, this makes like Lucy's the only one who hasn't fucked off for a whole arc at this point now and gone on a holiday. Like first Verona went on that holiday with her mom and
the
now
beach holiday. Yeah.
Yeah, and now Avery's obviously gone on some sort of spiritual, you know, dream find yourself journey. So Lucy's the only one who's taken this job seriously.
Mm. Yeah. Well done, Lucy, I guess.
There's been a lot of Avery tinfoil. I'm interested to get, like, where do you think Avery is, Ruben?
I think I DM'd you this. We were kind of talking about this while I was away. The simplest explanation I find, a trick that Wild Bo pulls on us sometimes is to make us think that the simplest explanation isn't right and there has to be a more complex explanation from some kind of breadcrumbs that we just don't realize how they fit in yet. but it ends up being the simplest explanation, and then we're left with the feeling of like, oh, we should have realized it's that. You know what I mean? I feel like that's happened a few times. So I think the simplest explanation is Avery is in the abyss. Whether she's dead or alive, I don't know, but in the abyss. And I just, like, that to me is what I'm going to stick with, I think. I'm not going to let Wildbo trick me into thinking something more complex is going on.
See, I've taken a different tack.
Yeah, you've fallen for the trick.
Yeah, I refuse not to fall for it. I have a new tinfoil that I haven't talked about in the past that I want to bring, which is that there was talk in 22.2 of the number 4 coming up a lot, and a lot of people tied that to, like, how in older Eastern traditions 4 is like the number of death and stuff.
I didn't know Eastern feels like a
relevant connection to make to that, right? Like, and she's a necromancer. I don't know what the limits of necromancy are, but like I'm just thinking maybe Ye Yun has a little bottle with Avery's soul in it.
But why? I guess.
Well, she's not technically Team Charles. I'm thinking Avery was the one who was hanging out with Ye Yun and Nomi with Juliet. And Avery kind of connected with them a bit. It would be very Avery to end up getting saved by some rando connection that she did make from the enemy.
Yeah, sure. So Ye Yun, this is not like Ye Yun has betrayed her, but more like Ye Yun has saved her.
Yeah, I think so. And then the step two, where it gets particularly wrinkly in the tinfoil, is if Avery is a soul in a jar, but her body is dead, that's where the Grobards come in as people who can give her a new body. Because I think it's about time we took that practice and turned it into something good.
Oh, this is a pretty hectic one. But I think it deserves a hearty huzzah.
Don't do it.
Too late.
Huzzah.
I like it. I like it. Interesting. Very interesting.
I just think the Grobards are like one of the few families where we haven't seen the Kennetiers enforce, like, hey, do your shit, but not shit. And giving something like Avery a new body would be an interesting way to explore the good side of the Grobard shtick.
Yeah, I could see it. All right. Well, I like it as a prediction. Let's see. I guess if you're right.
I've thrown a lot of spaghetti at the wall. If it's not that one, hopefully I've hedged my bets enough by spraying it everywhere.
You've sent enough predictions into the world that one of them will be right. So, obviously the other thing that we get to see here is Jasmine's back in the story, I guess. And she continues to be wonderful. Still, like, worried about Lucy, obviously, but doesn't take the tack of, like, I'm your parent, you need to chillax on all this crazy shit. Even though Avery has just died, she's still kind of supportive of Lucy and her situation, which is just like very, I don't know, mature of her, I guess is the right word, but it sounds a bit weird to say. But like, yeah, Jasmine, you're a hero, basically.
Yeah, I really liked the way Jasmine put it, where they have that conversation about how like Kelsey is seemingly a bit of a mess right now, which you would be. And Jasmine sort of works off what Lucy says to be like, don't ever put me in this situation where I don't know what's happened to you, which is an incredibly reasonable request. And, you know, she gets Lucy to commit to that sort of thing where it's like, you need to check in with me every hour, which I loved because I feel like when parents normally ask for that sort of thing, it's the parent being an unreasonable nag control freak, whereas this is like actually very reasonable of Jasmine to be like, just hourly check-ins, that's all I asked for.
Very reasonable by Jasmine in my opinion.
I'd love a Jasmine interlude, because this feels like this has been a big thing for the two of them. Like, we've seen Jasmine really struggle with like how this relationship has evolved, like her being able to see Lucy as a fighter and a leader and like still her, you know, little girl or whatever. Like, I'd love to see a Jasmine interlude specifically, because I'd love to see how this has worked for her internally, because she's obviously doing better externally at kind of letting Lucy do her thing, but I wonder internally what that looks like how internally Jasmine now compares to 2 to 3 arcs ago when she was like kind of trying to ultimatum Lucy into not doing stuff.
Yeah, it's good growth from Jasmine. I agree. Jasmine interlude would be very fun.
Yeah, like I think this has been a really important thing for both her and Lucy, and like I'd love to, yeah, really get some clarity on exactly what it looks like from Jasmine to understand that she can't protect Lucy anymore.
Fun location that they're in, the Lost Hotel.
Yeah,
which has a TV that lets them watch. I don't know. Are they live feeds of Paths, or are they just like fictional Lost TV shows? And Lost TV shows are just about Paths, which makes me think that the show Lost is probably on the TV here. I mean, it kind of makes sense for it to be. It feels like a show that is Lost with, you know, Lost feels like a Lost show, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
No, they even took it out of syndication on the Lost TV network because it didn't make any sense to any of the Foundlings either. Even the Foundlings like, this is nonsense.
That makes sense.
Like, this is stupid. My favorite little detail about the TV remote is like Lucy's frustration. She pushes down and it takes her to a channel. So she goes up and it takes her to a third different channel. And like, that is incredibly aggravating. I was like, no. Up is the opposite of down. It should send me back to where I was. Like, why, four directions was already a funny idea. And then the idea that up and down don't necessarily work as you'd expect. This is like, what is this?
Yeah, it is pretty funny how unintuitive the controls for these showers are.
We'll get to the showers as well. But I also wanted to call out, I loved the first description we get of this hotel room is like Lucy being like, yeah, there's mirrors everywhere. There's a mirror on the roof and mirrors on the wall. And I was going like, oh, dog tags, where have you taken these to exactly? Like, what sort of hotel is this? Mm-hmm. And so I thought it was a really fun fake out when it turned out it is just a funny Lost thing where it's like, oh yeah, mirrors let people with two dimensions have a third, or the steam kettles can fog it up and that does a thing. Like, it went in a real weird direction for a second and then turns into this fun whimsical Lost thing.
Yeah, you're right. There's almost an insidious vibe that dissipates very quickly and it goes into very fun moments. Lucy gets help from a Lost folk with her shower and she is finally able to prep for the day.
Yeah, and she doesn't even know how to use the three seashells. I thought this was really fun because it was like, the opening descriptor of this chapter is like Lucy thinking to herself, I'm home, but I'm not home. And I think there's no better way to really make that land than sticking Lucy in Kennet Found, because it's very much, it's Kennet and she's home and she's safe, but like Lucy fucking hates Kennet Found. And this shower is just like a perfect example of just how not upper alley it is. Whereas you can tell, like, Verona would see this shower thing and be like, ooh, like, I'm going to fiddle. And Avery would sort of, yeah, see it as a puzzle too. Whereas Lucy's just like, I just want a fucking shower. Why is this so hard?
It's hard, Lucy, because it's funny for us. That's why.
I really like how Lucy starts venting her frustration by like talking at Avery, and she's just like, I really just want to yell at you. You couldn't have picked something safe and like less hazardous, like being a goblin queen. That's so true. My favorite thing about the shower stuff, I think, is like at work at the moment, I'm very deep in a project where we're doing a lot of stuff around accessibility for like VR apps, and we're thinking a lot about like this trade-off you constantly run into with a lot of like user experience design of like simplicity versus inclusivity. Like, it's really hard not to make things more complicated and less intuitive as you try to add more options and be more inclusive. It's a really hard line to walk properly. And I really enjoy Kennet Found's approach of just being aggressively unintuitive in order to be as accessible as possible. Like, I guess as somebody who's dealing with walking that line on a daily basis, it's really funny to see something intentionally go the other way and just like, sorry, if you don't understand it, fuck you. This works for everyone. Like, just figure it out. I just love it. The Lost and the Foundlings are sick of being the ones who have to put in the work to get out of the quote unquote normal way of doing things and adjust the standards to fit them. And I love that it's just like, no, here's something that's equally kind of baffling to everyone, but we're used to that, so we get it.
Yeah, it's accessible to them through its weirdness, I guess. Like, the fact is the weird system is what makes it, I don't know, yeah, work for them, I guess.
Yeah, and that's what, like, Kenneth Found has been kind of that from day one. It's like, it seems to intentionally exist to, like, challenge your concept of, like, well, this is just the normal, easy way of doing things. It makes everything that should be normal and easy a weird hoop that a normal person has to jump through. It's just so fun. Especially one of the things Lucy notes is Jasmine has been staying in this hotel for a number of days. And when Lucy gets in there, the setting is this really shitty, like, mist setting. And Lucy realizes that her mom probably just, like, got something that wasn't going to kill her and was, like, good enough. and so I was just like, oh, this will be a nice surprise for Jasmine when she gets home and find out that, you know, Lucy used the powers of getting help to actually get them somewhat of a regular shower.
Yeah, it is funny that Jasmine has just been dealing with the mist shower. That's a good reveal.
I mean, that 100%, that's what I'd be doing. Like, especially if you're not comfortable with Lost or others in general, like, Jasmine probably isn't. But yeah.
Yeah.
And because we know the dogs are no fucking help.
Hey, can we talk about, I mean, Wabo is going mad with the fake outs this chapter and next chapter, but the Avery, the fake out of a Lost having run into Avery and then, oh no, turns out it was months ago. It's just so, it's such a dick move. I love it.
It was funny because I was very much right from the start. I was like, yeah, but that was probably ages ago, Lucy. But you can see why Lucy would let herself have hope of, like, because it would be extraordinarily Avery to be stranded on the path and just find someone and be like, hey, go visit my hometown. And if you see anyone there, give them a holler that I'm here. There is reason to hope, but it's just like, it's so optimistic by Lucy that that's what would have happened. Like, it doesn't make sense when you think about it.
Mm, yeah.
Also, his name is Mr. Ichneumonidae, which I googled, and it's a type of wasp. Very specifically, they're a wasp that, like, they're parasites, so they lay their eggs in other creatures. Like, they're that kind of wasp, you know, so they lay the eggs in the other creature, and then it eats the other creature from the inside out. And I was thinking, that reminds me, because this guy's so nice, and he doesn't seem to want to stick his eggs in people, as far as we've seen. But we saw Todd, who's that guy Avery ran into on the Forest Ribbon Trail and again in the Cakewalk, who's just a normal-looking dude who wants to lay his eggs in people from memory. So I'm wondering if this is, like, the other half of, like, you know, when whatever this wasp was got lost, the desire to lay the eggs in people got separated from the looking like a wasp thing, and they're two parts. It seems very unlikely. I don't know if this is how lost stuff works, but I love the idea that maybe those two are connected.
Interesting. Yeah, I like it.
Also, I love his vibe of, like, Lucy's like, can you give me any hints or clues about where you saw Avery or whatever? And he gets a bit all, actually, I'm on vacation from work right now. Like, I just thought that was such a funny attitude to bring to it. It's like, sorry, but, like, giving clues is my day job. Clues, I don't, yeah. Like, it's like, you know, like, my parents will come down for the holidays and they're like, oh, well, since we're visiting, can you help me with my phone? It's not doing XYZ. And it's like, this isn't what I'm really looking to do with my holidays, but sure, yeah. I guess.
If you want vague clues that lead you on life-altering journeys, come back on Monday, okay? Yeah, no, that was very funny. Lucy leaves the hotel and is looking for some allies, but instead finds some weirdly shaped people. Oh, no, wait, it's the goblins.
I really like the delivery on this. I did not get what was happening quite at first. I was like,
yeah,
what?
Me neither.
I was like, what is this lady? And then it really took until the word biscuit was thrown in there that I was like, oh, it's the goblins in glamour. Yeah. And then I, like, went back and reread them all. And I'm like, that's so fucking obvious. It's great.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, why is this little old lady obsessed with how big she is? Of course, because it's fucking tatty. Like,
yeah, no, it's very good. Every time the goblins are in goblin glamour, it's hilarious. Biscuit, of course, is annoying and the worst, and now by law, not the best goblin, so therefore terrible.
I'm not continuing the podcast until you apologize.
Well, I'm not gonna. But yeah, no, they're all pretty fun, obviously, other than Biscuit.
I love the beat of how Cherry has seemingly maybe kind of not understood or circled so around being wrong, but she's right again.
So good. Oh, like, my God.
Cherry is just the purest goblin where she's like, she doesn't buy into any of the bullshit. She's like, nah, that's just glamour. Like, she's just seeing right through it and all the other stuff. So, remember when she almost beat Marissica in, like, arc 12 or it was like during Phineas trial, I think there was a moment where Cherry Pop almost beat Marissica because she was like too stupid to distract, and it's like this is that moment where you really see what like pure goblin that beats fairy shit is about. Like, Cherry Pop is just so fucking stupid you can't trick her.
Yeah, like she can't be manipulated with words, which presumably is what Toady did to the others, like to sell this to them. It's very good. It's very funny.
And then, like, there's just a number of moments that the goblins excel. I love the bit where Lucy's like, okay, there's trouble. You know, everyone go do something, but don't go too hard. And then the next line of dialogue was just Ram Jam immediately started sprinting to the...
Yeah. And it pays off when he comes skidding down the... skidding down on a sled and just slams into people. It's very funny.
Yeah, and it's just, like, I love, like, that's so, like, Ram Jam is just somebody who seems to either go at 100 or 0. Like, I love that Lucy's like, don't go too hard. And with Ram Jam, it's like, sorry, but you're either getting 0 or you're getting 100. Like, you pick.
Yeah. So let's talk about this. They're looking for Bracken and Bag or the family man, right? Like, those are their kind of stated goals of this mission. And obviously Bracken and Bag make sense, like they're allies and friends, and like, you know, if they're in trouble, we want to rescue them. Great.
It's actually low-key horrifying that they've been like kidnapped or some shit.
Yes.
Like,
yes. Yeah. The family man though is interesting, right? Because obviously the family man is like the other kind of divine-ish being that we know of other than Marcy. And so when we talk about the family man being important for some reason, all I can think of is like, how does it factor in? It's obviously got to do with either stopping the family man from being an asset to Marcy or using the family man somehow as an attack vector against Marcy. But I don't know. It's very exciting, whatever it is.
Yeah, because he's had a number of mentions this arc already. I think he came up like in the last two chapters too. So it's like there's something. I think it was Oakham. I'm struggling not to keep calling her Melissa. But yeah, like Oakham brought him up last week as well, I think, as like a... He's running around. And yeah, I'm kind of with you. I'm like, I don't know whether I think he's going to side with Marissica or be a third party or something. But it's like, it feels like we're setting him up for something. I have no idea what it is, but I'm excited because he was a fun villain.
Yeah. As Izzard did it in chat, it says the implication is that he was behind Bracken and Bag's disappearance, which could be right. Obviously, they have a bit of a history.
Sure.
But yeah, I don't know. It's very interesting.
Yeah, but like why... like. Why would, like, from at the very least, from a metatextual perspective, it's like, why would Walbo reintroduce the family man as a factor at this point in the story?
Yes, yes,
unless we're like going somewhere with it, and I don't know what that looks like, so I'm excited. Like, I feel like he could end up on Charles and Marissica's side, but then I don't remember exactly what he was like enough. It could go either way, I don't know. Like, but then he can't work with Kennet, so. Also, oh no, you know why he can't work with Marissica? Doesn't he get sick at the sight of blood now? Wasn't that a thing, Verona?
Oh, sorry,
that was a curse Lucy put on him, I think. Like, yeah, he can't stand blood. So he's not on Marissica's side. That would be a hell of like enemy of my enemy type deal for him to team up with Kennet.
That is quite an interesting one. But then again, Marcy is powerful enough to maybe deal with those curses.
True. I do think, like, I love that Melissa is kind of, I was really on board with Melissa and Bracken as a thing, and I kind of hope that Melissa gets her moment to absolutely kick someone's ass for taking Bracken. That would be very fun.
That would be fun. So yeah, we get a fight breaking out pretty quickly. So it's Lucy, the dogs, and the gobs taking on some undersiders while trying to download some security camera footage, which is a classic ticking clock. Oh no, it's downloading. Oh, 14%. Oh, 23%. Oh, they're getting closer. 92%. No, it's very classic, which is good. I love the way the goblins fight here. And actually it jumped out to me, like, in this chapter, but also in the next chapter, the Kennet Others and Kenneteers Lucy especially, like, use the town as a weapon, like use the innocence of the town as an extension of a way to fight, because they've kind of earned this connection to the town. And I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, although I do love, like, Taddy really skirts the line, though, because she kind of tries to lean into the role of the vulnerable old lady being assaulted by a man, which is, like, a great thing to get the public to take her side. But she's also, like, screaming obscenities. Like, she's got a real sailor's mouth on her as she's doing it. She's like, oh, he tried to touch me in my saggy tits, you pervert. Like, which is just, like, sort of wearing away a bit at the image of her as, like, the innocent old lady being attacked, which I really liked. But yeah, I think that's a really good point about how they're using the town as a weapon. And I got somewhere in the notes later. There's definitely some stuff to talk about with, like, what exactly, because Lucy is thinking on it here and she thinks on it later on too. There's, like, some stuff going on about why they're attacking some places and not others that feels like there's something we're missing there. So, yeah, I forgot what I wrote for it, though, so we'll have to wait till we get to that part of the notes. I also really loved, this is where Lucy figures out that the Negateers and co. have reworked the perimeter so it kind of detects any practice, which allows them to basically home in on her very quickly.
Yes.
Because there was so much talk, like, way back in Arc 9 about Charles being able to change the perimeter to weaken practice to hurt the Kenneteers back when we thought some of the others were evil, and, you know, it turns out it was Charles. But it felt like a really fun callback to, like, the ways people talked about the perimeter being manipulated back in Arc 9. It was like, oh, like, Charles has sort of seen something like that through. He's given it to the Negateers and allowed them to do stuff like this with it. That's really fun.
It is fun. It is just very fun. Of course, the other fun part of this fight to me is Lucy avoiding the three grabs, and I guess at a wider level, like, the way that Lucy weaves her goblin and fae fighting lessons as she uses them into the fights is just a really entertaining way for these fights. Like, it's very entertaining to read about, I guess.
Yeah, because doesn't she sort of say it's like the way she's punching and striking at them is a bit like that's like Guillaume's sort of thing, but it was really Bubble Yum who taught her,
yeah.
Yeah, to just fucking break their fingers as they grab for you, essentially.
Yeah.
And you know what? Fair enough. They're trying to drag her into the abyss. Like, do it.
Yep. Hey, that seems pretty powerful, right? So they can, you know, the Abyssal Soldiers obviously can't really die. Also can do, like, free abyss fast travel. Yeah, I mean, I know Marcy's like a goddess or whatever, but pretty unfair the amount of power she gives to these soldiers with seemingly, as far as we know so far, no drawbacks. Or the drawback is you're indentured to Marcy, I guess.
Yeah, which for her, like, she's convinced them all to do it. So it's like, agree. I feel like there's going to be some sort of catch. Like,
yes,
are they
yes.
becoming more hers or more abyssal? How much is Marcy aligned with the abyss as a whole? Like, I don't know if the abyss has a sentience, but, like, you know what I mean? Like, how much?
Yeah.
She's like an abyssal god. Well, no, because she's like a blood goddess with ties to the abyss. So, yeah, like, I guess the other thing, like, they become less human and more abyssal or othery when they do it, which, like, I hate to be sort of leaning into that, but that's obviously, like, in terms of the seal, them being less human and more other is presumably a bit of a thing. And, like, I don't know that I want the Kenneteers to use that, but it would maybe be useful if Marisica is slowly turning her army more and more other as opposed to human. That might hurt them in some way.
Right. Like, they can bind them or they'll have more rules they have to follow. Sure.
Which is like, yeah, again, I feel like this is the line the Kenneteers keep getting asked across. That feels like a shitty thing to take advantage of, but, like, you know, Marisica's being the shit one first, so I guess.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think you're right. I think there'll probably be some kind of downside that the Kenneteers will learn to exploit. But you know, yeah, we'll see.
I'm easily impressed pointing out they're getting more and more connected to her, so they're an avenue to attack her directly, maybe. That's a fun thought. Yeah, I don't know. I'm wondering, like, a big thing I feel like we keep seeing with the culprits is that they're not actually aligned as they make out. And so the idea that Marisica is kind of making this deal with some abyssal force to kind of make them a bit more Abyssal when she revives them, but they're not technically hers and she suffers because of that misalignment. That would be fun. But anyway. Okay, so this is the part. So this is the part where Lucy brings up that, yeah, there's some shit not adding up with, like, where the culprits are and aren't attacking. Like, they haven't taken over places like the hospital in Canada Above, which would be a primo target, but they did, like, raid Killaloe Doe and some other place I don't care about. Like, there's some more info to be garnered here about why they're attacking some places and not others in Canada Above. I was wondering if hospitals maybe kind of count as sacred ground a little bit in the modern day.
Yes, I think that's probably true.
Like, just from the, you know, their places of healing, you're not really meant to bring violence there. I don't know exactly how it's worked historically, but it feels like hospitals like the last place to attack. In the same way a school might somewhat be sacred ground.
Yeah, for sure.
It also had me thinking, so something that's really set up in these two chapters is the idea that, like, there's, it's sort of Kennet Found versus Kennet Below, and Kennet Above is in the middle. There's a, like, Kennet Found has that red moon time, right? Mm. Where all the violence is allowed.
Mm.
I hope one of those isn't coming up soon.
Yeah, I know, right? It's going to be, I don't know what it's going to be, but it's going to be something, and I'm not, like, I'm worried about it.
That will be a fight. Like, I'm just picturing the thing where Mist comes out and's like, hey guys, just a heads up, it's red moon in 2 days, so
it's happening. Let's
shore up our defenses.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think the red moon is definitely going to be an opportunity for the evil folk to make a play.
Oh, it'll be a big fight. Like, that will for sure be a huge set piece.
Yeah, I can't wait for it. Lucy and the gang get away from this encounter without really any more additional information, but her and Verona do end up having a nightmare meeting, I should say, and they decide it's time to take off the kid gloves.
But, like, I guess we've got to call out, I love the decoration of this dream meeting. Like, Lucy's being confronted with all of the faces of people whose deaths she feels responsible for, and I love this really dark detail that, the names and faces get less clear as they're newer. Like, that totally does make sense. Mm. And it's also so upsetting and depressing. Like, Lucy thinks on it and she's like, oh, that sucks. And I'm like, yeah, it really does. Like, she doesn't even remember Milo Sonjate's name, which I'm like, oh, fuck Milo, that's fine. But it's sad for Lucy that the deaths have become so numerous and close together that they're blurring and she doesn't remember who's who.
Mm. Yeah. Pretty rough. I mean, I don't know if you need to remember Milo's name, because
I'm fine with that shit, part, but it's the general trend that it's upsetting.
Yes, for sure. I feel you.
And also, I think that's part John of the is nightmare. There.
Mm. Oh yeah, yep. John's there.
I enjoy John.
Of course, John's there. Like, John is always hanging over Lucy's subconscious, I suppose.
Yeah, and then Abe's there too for a bit, but Lucy's like, no, we're not doing that.
Mm-hmm.
I did have an interesting thought earlier in the chapter, and I'm not sure if it is anything or where to go with it, but I thought it was interesting that Lucy does seem to be hanging out a lot more with Doe these days, and she doesn't seem to have quite the same awkwardness with Doe as she has with people like Grandfather. I wonder how much it is the fact that Doe doesn't feel like she's just replacing John because Doe, like, is a woman and doesn't sort of slot into that same, you know, fatherly sort of kind of role model position.
Yeah, it's a good point. We'll see, I suppose, if I don't know what role Doe is gonna play. I still have this sick feeling in the back of my head of, like, we have to find a new Carmine candidate, even though that's not really the plan anymore.
Somebody kind of needs to step up for the play. Yeah, sorry, this is a good point. Somebody, Zachary in the chat, has said Doe replaces Avery, which is a fair point. I forgot it is hunting season for all deer themed characters. Doe should be worried. Yeah,
well, maybe Doe, the fact that Doe is called Doe is, you know, is an indicator that Doe is going to replace a deer.
Well, no, because between the Alabaster and Avery, like, it's just all deer. I mean, she gets shot in this chapter, which is very on theme for the deer-related characters right now, but she needs to be extra shot compared to the others.
Mm. But yeah, so the way this chapter ends is by Lucy saying, all right, kid gloves off, basically. And then the next chapter starts with Harry getting mutilated by Lucy. And I just, I'm so on board for it. And it was so sad when I found out that it was fake.
I agree. There was like, I felt like a bit of a bad person because there were parts of me who were like, so I, for me, it was the bit where Teddy, we start Teddy's bit and he's Christmas shopping. And I think that was the point where I was like, well, this must be a dream because they already done Christmas. Mm. But like for Harry's part, it was just a part of me. I was like, this, I can't believe Lucy would actually horrify someone. It was like, it felt weird, but like part of me was like, fucking good.
I was so on board with it. Yeah. I guess let's talk about it. So yeah, we with Harry, who is ambushed by Lucy but refuses to back down, and you know, Lucy is kind of talking to her and giving her a chance to, you know, disavow Charles and Marcy, I guess, in a way where Lucy and the Kennedys will help her get out of this situation.
Yeah, and I thought it was very funny. The first thing that happens in this nightmare is her phone breaks. I just felt very teen nightmare. Like that was one of the things where on a reread I was like, oh, obviously this is a nightmare. Her phone broke.
Well, yes, the phone breaking I think is an easy explanation for cutting her off from the ability to call for help, which wouldn't make sense because she's in a nightmare. But you're right, it is. I'm sure breaking a teen's phone in a nightmare is very, doesn't require a lot of power because they're basically ready for it.
Yeah. So we've got a comment from Wabo the chat who said, apparently I it seems like I kind of misread Teddy's shopping part, and it was like the Christmas present is the shopping spree or whatever, which is like, I guess lucky for me that I misread it. because I was, I don't know. I did read the chapters back to back as well. I took so long to read 22.3 that 22.4 was already out. So they'd just been in the nightmare. So I guess I was just a bit primed to be like, hold on a second. But just going back to what you say, yeah, definitely like part of me was like, as the horrifying was happening, I was like, I can't believe Lucy would do this. Like it just didn't feel real. And then the nightmare part happened and I was like, oh, actually, I really kind of like it. Like I think there's a really interesting ethical discussion to kind of be had around like torturing people in nightmares like this. Mm. And I guess it kind of goes back to the debate they had around giving a nightmare to Brett in like arc two, but it's like it, like, is it okay for Lucy to torture someone like Harry like this with a horrifying, if it's only in a dream? Cause I feel like my answer is yes.
Yeah.
But only because Lucy also hops into the dream and tells her exactly why this is happening and gives her a chance to not, to change.
Mm.
Like the issue with Alby's dreams at the start of the story tended to be she just give you a horrible time, but there was no reason for you to actually reflect on what happened because it was just a dream.
Yeah. Yeah, this is very explicitly Lucy forcing them to confront things, and as well as getting a safe answer to, if we had a way out for you, would you take it? Question.
Yeah, but then even the stick in this scenario is only temporary, and
yes,
it's very clear why Lucy has done this to you. Lucy's saying "fuck you" for horrifying someone and refusing to repent. Here you go.
Yeah, yeah. No, I absolutely love. Like once it, I was sad when we found out it was a nightmare because I'm just on board with Lucy's vibe, I guess. But it obviously makes a lot of sense, like conceptually. What they're doing is they're saying, hey, you fucked around so much, this is your final warning. This is what's going to happen to you kind of stuff, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's great. Like, it's, they're being so good to these fucking negatives. They really shouldn't. But yes, I think it's great. Hey, can we talk about how Harry is a psychopath? because Harry says, yes, I would rather murder and maim people and then die then never have a small taste of power and continue to live my sea life, you know, and that's just ridiculous. Harry, you have the ability to change your life in smaller ways than by murdering and maiming people, so just I don't know, chillax. I guess.
Yeah, I do. I think this is touching on a really important thing that kind of is pale white as well as negative white. Because I can I can see 13-year-old Elliot thinking that too, just like Harry did.
Mm.
Because I think there is a lot of, I don't know, media or just like life stuff that kind of tries to encourage you, like to celebrate people who are special and like, you know, like people who are famous or who are rich and who are the like ones who are just like quote unquote better and like they're the special main characters of life or whatever. And like, I think everyone goes through this period, like where you start to realize that you maybe aren't one of those people. Like you're not going to be,
you're not going to get your letter from Hogwarts on your 11th birthday.
And so I think the negative is a really fun way to explore this because they're kind of around these ages where I think everyone kind of has to reconcile the fact that they're not one of life's main characters. And that's a particularly funny analogy in this story. But like, yeah, like, you know, you kind of instilled through the stories we tell and the way society celebrates certain people to like believe that there are those other people out there who are the main characters. And you're realizing you're just not one of them. And it's like Liz and Charles and co have kind of weaponized that desire and insecurity to become like what, like this foundational thing for the Red Heron kids of all. Yeah. Like they've all been twisted to the point where they're like, I would rather do all this horrible shit than just be mediocre.
Mm.
And I think that's interesting because it's actually kind of the opposite of what Miss has, like right from the get-go, Miss with the Kenneteers has just sort of been like, hey, chase your bliss, no pressure. I mean, very specifically, they're like, don't even solve the murder, literally no pressure. Like just thrive within your community. You don't have to be a world famous practitioner. You can just be good enough for us. I think this has been right through Payo. Like, I remember Booker had a thing really early in the story where Booker was like, I'd rather be a like low-level politician helping people than a high-level one who doesn't achieve as much on a big scale or whatever. And, like I think this is something Payo places a lot of importance on is your local community, and this is a side of it of, like, you don't need to be special. And, like, the trap the Negateers have been twisted into falling for is that they all want – they would all rather be – a candle burning twice as bright for half as long rather than just being happy.
Yeah. But yeah, I do think maybe I'm just kind of arguing semantics here, but I do think it's worth pointing out. It's not even twice as bright for half as long, right?
Well, yeah.
The trade-off really is more like 20 times as bright for 100th as long.
Yes.
Like yeah. I don't know. So short-sighted, yeah. I guess.
But 100% 13-year-old Elliot was like, I was one of those kids who was kind of in like the, like, I got put in a special stream for quote unquote gifted kids, which I very quickly burnt out of. But it was like, you know, I definitely aspired to be world famous or whatever. And it was about that age when I realized that wasn't going to probably happen for me. And so like, I really love that this is, sort of what is happening to these kids. Cause I can 100% see myself as I was reconciling with that fact and making that trade-off of going, well, I can have it for a little bit and everything else will be worse and it'll be very quick, but I'll have it for a bit.
It's interesting. I don't know. I also kind of have this thought of like, they could, if they weren't pieces of shit, change to the Kenneteers' side and get basically the same benefits without being pieces of shit. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
If I was in a position to be either a Kenneteer or a Negateer, I'd be like, okay, one side I get, you know, obviously the Kenneteers have a lot of power, right? Like the three of them are going up against the whatever 8-10 Negateers and holding their own, if not winning. Like, I'm going to pick the side where I can be good and do good and make change in a lasting way and still get the power rather than the side where I get maybe more power in the short term but die and also have to be a piece of shit. Like, it's not a good trade.
But the Red Heron kids don't see it as a choice. Like, they didn't get picked for the Kenneteers. This is the angle Adrian really takes that I really loved. Like, Adrian points out nobody wanted him. His parents didn't want him, and then he found out Miss didn't choose him because these three girls are better. Like, it's a bit of a fuck you. He's not the special kid. He's not the hero. He's not the protagonist. He's just some other kid. And like, so for them, it's like, they're not going to be Kenneteers if they switch over. They are like, they're the trio of Kenneteers. You're always going to be their second fiddle, even if you switch sides. So.
Yeah. But I mean, like, you're in the world now, Adrian, like
yeah, yeah.
Oh, go yeah. find no. your own Kennet. If you don't want to be second fiddle to the Kenneteers, do your own, like, do, just
no. I don't.
There's other ways.
I'm on your side, but I can see why they don't see it like that.
Yeah, sure.
Because I mean, the grand irony of all this is these are a bunch of kids who want to be special, and they've been warped by these guys, and they want to blink out and be special. The Kenneteers have had no fucking pressure to be special, and they're pretty much all world renowned now anyway. Like, what's funny is, like, the Kenneteers just being able to be themselves and try to be happy has led to them getting exactly the success that the Negateers crave so much.
Yeah. It's just, they're just silly, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I also like Harry specifically links it to an idea of feeling like she has control.
Yeah.
Because you see this talked about a lot in terms of, like, what leads, like, you know, young white guys into, like, the alt-right pipeline and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I think the other side of, like, the whole feel like wanting to feel special or, like, belonging and stuff, the other side of that is this sense of control. A lot of people feel out of control in their lives, and it's very easy to misdirect them about what has taken that control away from them and co-opt them. And so, like, I feel like that's touching on exactly that side of things from real life too. Sorry, it is worth pointing out Harry's home life doesn't seem that bad. Like,
it's not
no, Nomi's was borderline, Kirilin's wasn't great, but like I remember I did look it up to double check. Harry's thing was like, oh, Harry's mum throws tantrums and is not, like, not that good, and, you know, that's why she hates life, and she's a bad mom, and, you know, her dad's more of a rock or whatever. And, like, we see them all interact here, and it's like, okay, her mom maybe isn't perfect and maybe has some mental health issues or something that everyone's working through with her or whatever, but, like, they seem pretty great in this. Like, for a nightmare, her parents are absolutely not bad.
Yeah, no, they could be much worse, couldn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, Harry went back down, so Lucy horrifies her, and it's very fun, and I wish it was real.
The fuck around and find out energy from this moment is very strong.
Mm-hmm.
I particularly love Lucy giving her a little bit of it and then pulling more out and being like, oh, sorry, I wasn't clear. This part was just for what you did to Jillian and Chase. This part is for killing Edith, fucking with my home, and, like, just making it 100 times less. Fucking love
mm-hmm.
it.
It's very good.
I'm such a terrible person. I enjoyed this far too much.
I do, like, love... Yeah. No, you're right. I enjoyed it
somebody,
a lot as well.
As somebody who intellectually is constantly trying to advocate for, like, more restorative justice and less, like, punishment and stuff, I'm definitely not fully deprogrammed, because part of me sees stuff like this and I'm like, yeah, fucking fuck you. Like,
yeah.
My id and my super ego aren't fully balanced on this one.
Yeah. I think it was very funny. Just something that just made me laugh about this section was when Harry screams, her mum runs in, and then she's like, get out, mum, get out. And I was just like, what am I doing? I just thought that was hilarious.
I kind of got a little bit lost in that, because I got the impression Lucy had poured alcohol on her at first, and I thought she was about to get in trouble for having alcohol. And I thought that was really funny because it was like, oh, you know, now she's going to get caught. And then it was like, it ended up being so much worse. But I was like, I was so confused that her mum wasn't noticing all the alcohol on her.
Yeah. good stuff.
Yeah, I underestimated Lucy.
It's very funny. So, yeah, Lucy next goes after Teddy, who's doing some post-Xmas shopping with his family. And she bogs him down with innocent legal issues, which is very good. I love the vibe of, like, fucking with him by telling his parents, like, he's acting like a petulant child. You get treated like a petulant child. Yeah, you're getting told onto the police and to your parents.
Yeah. Which is funny. Well, like, unlike the horrifying one, this is one where I was like, hey, do this IRL. Like, this doesn't need to be a dream punishment. Let's just move this shit into live action. You know, talking about the ethics of whether it's okay to horrify people in dreams, this is one I'm absolutely like, no, let's take this energy and pull it forward. Because I think to a degree, like, these scenes are fueled by the nightmares of each, like, Red Heron kid, each Negateer. Because we talk a lot later on about how this is also a fact-finding mission, which I love as, like, a dual-purpose sort of thing. Like, we're seeing what insecurities Teddy has through his nightmare. But yeah, like as much as this was just an attack direction kind of controlled by the dream, part of me is like, but can't we investigate the possibility of doing something like this in the real innocent world, maybe?
Yeah. I think a good play, a good way to go after Teddy.
I love Mr. Black makes an appearance too. Like, especially when you don't know this was a dream. It's just really nice to have like the people in authority kind of coming up and be like, oh yeah, that's Lucy. She's legit. Like, yeah. Just, yeah. Love it.
Yeah. Very good stuff. yeah. I love that they've earned the cred to let them do this stuff. Like they've fought for this town and good on them. Adrian is the next one to get a visit from the ghost of Christmas future. He attempts to fight back, but he ends up maddening himself, similarly with Travis and Kirilin, who runs to Marcy and stays there.
Oh, we'll get to that last bit, but I love that Adrian and Travis's nightmares are both just being Leonard's new apprentice. Like, that was one of those bits where, especially once you're aware it's the nightmares, you just sort of reading it and you're like, yeah, 100%, like that, I would probably be third in line for that nightmare.
Yeah, for sure. That's a rough one. I don't know, I'm kind of sad that each of the negatives is given the chance to back down, but nobody does. Like, I was hoping that the Kennedys would get through to one or two of them, but yeah, nah, nobody does. Their hit rate is really low, and it's sad.
Yeah, I mean, I guess as pointed out multiple times in the chapter, this is essentially the third out, and I guess what we're seeing is like the funnel for the first two has already kind of gotten, you know, most of the things that'll fit down it already. And chat's pointing out there's like a few of them who seemingly have been like a little bit shifted or are definitely going to have a few more doubts, but like, yeah, I think the kids who are willing to straight up turn around and leave this shit behind are the ones who've already taken the opportunity.
Yeah, I guess that's true. It's just like, I was hoping that seeing the consequences of their actions a bit more actively would, I don't know, help bring it home, but it doesn't seem to.
Yeah. I mean, I guess we'll see if any of their behaviors change going forward or, yeah, what, like, because this is definitely, in terms of engagements with the negatives, like this is kicking the hornet's nest. Like these two groups are kind of going to be fully at war, which they already were, but now they're going to be specifically seeking the Kenneteers out, you think?
Yep, for sure.
We've already touched on it a little, but this is where Adrian really expresses the envy he has for the Kenneteers and them being chosen and him not being, which I like fully understand like why that would drive someone like this, but I thought the line that was really good that really landed is the part where he says to Lucy, I never had a teacher that cared about me, I never had a friend who stuck by me, which is like those were the things that the Kennedys only, like Avery only had Miss Hardy and Lucy and Verona like only had each other. And Adrian is here and he's like, I didn't even have that, like I was in a worse place than when you three started this story and I didn't get chosen. Like, that actually, like, gutted me.
Yeah, but the way that you're acting now is evidence that it was the right choice, so fuck you.
I don't think that's fair.
Nah, it like, is.
He got picked up by, you know, Charles and Marcy and Liz. Like, he never stood a chance.
Maybe. I don't know. I just, like, Adrian, you're digging your own grave, so I have no sympathy for you at this point.
I don't know. I still do, but I kind of still do for Charles as well, so I think I may be just a little too forgiving.
Yeah, I think so. So we now jump back in time, and Lucy's hanging out with the hooligans of Half Street, which, let's just say right now, is a great name for Verona's gang. It's very good.
I fucking love that. Yeah, like really taking ownership of their chaotic goblin energy. I kind of want, there was that girl, I think her name was Cass. She was kind of the Verona of the Blue Heron trio of like Yadira, Raquel, and I think it was Cass. She had like a Clockwork Orange vibe going. And anyway, so she needs to be added as another hooligan.
Yeah, sure.
I love how Anselm is just fully embracing just being a prop, just being like the eye candy. Like I remember one of the first things we learned about the Undercity in Arc 14 was that like a lot of social and gender roles were reversed. Like I remember we would see the high school girls getting in fist fights over who got to date one of the boys. Like it was a flip off the classic tropes of like boys fighting over a girl or whatever.
Yeah.
And so Anselm being the guy who's just a part of the group of girls as the eye candy, like the anti-Black Widow or whatever, it just fits in that vibe very well. I thought that was great.
Yeah. yeah. Good stuff. We also find out some very sad news here. Stu Mullen has been removed.
R.I.P.
He's probably... R.I.P. No. He's just... They knew they couldn't deal with him, so they offered him all expense paid cruise to the Bahamas, and he's just hanging out there.
sure.
But yeah, the old bodies in Rook have switched sides. We already knew about Rook, obviously. BSW's not doing so hot. Like, the underside is... in a pickle, I guess.
Yeah, and so this is where we really start to get that picture of Kennet Below is very much controlled by the culprits. Kennet Found is very much controlled by, the goodies. And neither of those controls is at 100%, but those two groups are mostly on one side or the other. And so then, Kennet Above is kind of sitting as this weird middle ground where it feels like Charles and Co. have the upper hand, but like that feels like where the war is going to kind of be centered, I guess, at the moment is like, and you know, I'm thinking a lot of Megafire's model of the id, ego, and super ego for each of the Kennets. And it kind of feels like you got the id with the culprits and the super ego and Kennet Found with the goodies, and they're kind of waging war for control over the ego in the middle.
Yeah.
And I guess I can't wait to see how that that starts to shape up, because that feels like the conflict that's going to be driving the next little bit of the story.
Yeah, yeah, very interesting. Yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah, we've still got most of this arc left, and Avery's not coming back, so there's going to be more shit to deal with here in Kennet.
Are you just very confidently saying that Avery's not coming back all arc over and over again so that you'll be wrong? Because that's a good strat.
That is like a good strategy.
If we just constantly lay out that we're very sure she isn't, like, given the track record of this show, she'll be back in a couple of hours.
I'm not just saying this, like, I am confident she's not coming back this arc. And if I'm proven wrong, fine. But if otherwise, I'll be right. It's kind of a win-win for me.
I love that. Yeah, I do. I think it will be fun, and I get the vibe that she'll be gone for the whole arc. So I think that's the more fun answer. I think it would be fun to let us sit on it and see how the Kenneteers continue to cope without her.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, shout out to Oakum for how much, like here she really just, they're like, we're going to start to get technical. And she's like, I don't want to be tainted by knowledge. I'm out of here. And I was like, holy fuck, who are you? Like, that is... Oh, what a character growth for the last 7 months or whatever it's been since she was limping around being a pain in everyone's ass.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Well done, Melissa. Oh, Oakum. Sorry.
Yeah. It's so hard to, yeah. I've been really struggling to make that change.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she's continuing to lean into being a fun PI, which I love. I really want to see her beat the shit out of like the family man or whoever's got Bracken and Bag. I think it would be so fun for her to come to Bracken's rescue while he's a damn in distress.
Yeah. But yeah, so they have a discussion about how the Negatives don't sleep, and this kind of leads the way to their attack vector, nightmares, which obviously led into what we saw previously.
Yeah. I feel like we said this when we saw that Nomi had like her twilight ritual thing to get a few extra hours in the day, but like, sign me up for this shit.
Oh,
like
100%.
The Negatives only need to sleep like 1 hour a day or something. Like,
yeah,
100%.
It's very good. Obviously, the downside of this is the reveal that the kid gloves off Lucy stuff is fake, which is surprising to me. And like, Also surprising to me that I was so on board with it, but I was. yeah, like Avery missing means no holds barred. Actually, something we didn't mention but is worth mentioning, I think, is Harry, we get the reveal that the Negatives don't know where Avery is either. So
yeah,
it seems unlikely that she's being held captive or anything like that, right? Because they would probably know about that.
So yeah, after 22.3 came out, you did send me a DM saying, oh my God, it's another murder mystery, which is like, you know, not necessarily yes. a murder mystery, but I do love your idea that we're back to the roots of the story. It's kind of a whodunit.
Who done it and what has been done it.
yeah. Who done it and what did they do?
Yeah.
Oh, fucking, how funny would it be if the answer ends up being that Douglas did it? Douglas has had Avery this whole time. He did it.
Oh my God, that would be so good if it's true. That would be so fucking funny. Oh my God. Yeah.
But yeah, this is where we really start to appreciate how multi-prong this plan is as an approach, because they're also just gathering information. Like, especially as well for us as readers, like we learned a lot about some of the Negatives we didn't get POVs from. Like I learned kind of a bit more about how Harry functions, because it was a pseudo short interlude for really like part of her thing. And, you know, same with like Adrian, we weren't a little bit more than Freeman could see from him, because Freeman was too fucking dense to really get Adrian. But I did think it was fun that the one they couldn't get any info on was Cameron, because she's perfectly designed to work against this, and like also is just the one who I'm kind of, she's the perspective I need to see the most, because I'm like, sorry, but who is this girl who thinks Seth is cool?
Yeah, that's the weirdest thing of all. They must have done some surgery to cut out the actual discerning parts.
Yeah, but no, so it's kind of fun knowing that Cameron is going to come out of this as the person who is, oh, like the Negative, presumably the most crafty for thinking that augury way of like larger battle strategy stuff. She's also the one who like they didn't learn about. So her shifting into more of a leadership role and calling shots here would make sense and be terrifying.
Yeah.
Also, I love they do get info on Kirillin, but it's because their read on her was so bad that they're like, oh, we'll send her straight to Marcy. That would be awful. And Kirillin was all fucking for it. Like, they so fundamentally misunderstood how fucked up Kirillin is that they didn't think that she'd be just celebrating being closer in Marissica's womb. I love that.
Yeah. So, yeah, the gals realize they're overlooking somebody, Liz, who is almost certainly next on the chopping block with Edith being dead. And ding, 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 here she comes.
Somebody's ears were burning.
And this is funny because Liz also had this thought like an arc or two ago, right? Like we knew this was something Liz was worried about, explicitly seeing how Edith went. And that's what led to the Negatives, right? Is because Liz was like, I need something that's my thing so that I have a bit of stability, you know? And Charles was like, yep, here's a gift. It's the Negatives. And, but yeah, the fact that they're kind of more Marcy's and Charles's than they feel like they're Liz's is, I don't know, very interesting.
Yeah, I agree. Especially because I can't remember when it was, but I feel like we talked about at one point the idea of shifting the idea of the Avery culprit, as much as you can map them one-to-one, being away. It was no longer Edith, it was now Liz. And I love the idea that, like, yeah, Avery was the third wheel for the Kennedys initially, and they kind of embraced her and said, no, it's okay, you're not like our third wheel, you're an equal part of this group. And we're seeing the culprits do the opposite with their new third wheels. It's like, oh, well, now that Avery's romantic side is relevant to the conversation, toss her out and we'll pull in Avery's connection map better as the new third, but we're still totally willing to fuck her over as well. Like, they're, Marissica and Charles are nowhere near as good about doing good stuff to their third wheel. And especially, like, it's so funny to me that this conversation is happening while Avery is missing. If Liz is the new Avery culprit, it's going to be so fun seeing how Verona and Lucy kind of ping off of her in this conversation.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to this conversation, because Liz is obviously not going to be friendly with them, but I think Liz realizes that she's in a rough spot.
Yeah, I feel like her take is just going to be general grumpiness at everyone, and it's going to take a lot for the Kennedys to break through that, but yeah, it'll be fun to see.
Yeah. But that's the end of the chapters for this Christmas episode. But it's not the end of the Christmas episode because we've got some predictions and some discussion question answers to discuss. Let's start with the predictions. Predictions that people have left in the Pale Predictor or some Reddit comments that we really liked.
Sorry, huzzah.
Huzzah. I guess I've got a prediction that I saw two people leave, so I want to pull it out. It was left by Belegtal and Fergrungug, which is that we know that there's a fake Avery running around, the Finder. There's going to be a fake out. There's going to be a fake out where they think there's an Avery, but it turns out to be the Finder.
My only issue with this prediction is I think the longer the Finder is potentially just running around or we don't know where they are, the funnier it is to me. I almost don't want it to get used just because I want us to forever be sitting here like, so is the Finder out there still? What's that about?
Yeah, don't know, but yeah.
But yeah, I, you know, talking about Avery needing a new body, well, here's one.
Okay.
This is, you know, get Yiyun to take Avery's soul out of the little fairy bottle that she's got and put it in the Finder, I guess. Bing, bang, yes. Boom.
Okay. Yes. Let's see if that happens.
But yeah, and I pulled out a comment from Reddit. This was in 22.4's Reddit thread. And this was from I'm Easily Impressed. So it's kind of still in honor of the prediction segment. But I'm Easily Impressed did point out we didn't see Cameron's nightmare, but I'm Easily Impressed hopes that it was Seth dumping her. And I like that. And so I wanted to bring it out because I agree that would be funny and she deserves it.
And I mean, it'll be good for her, right? Like,
yeah, yeah.
If Seth actually dumped her, I mean, which I guess since it's a nightmare is not the case, but.
Anything that is breaking this being her type of guy is a force for good in the world. You know what I mean? Like,
yes, yes.
Torturing her in her nightmares to make her angry at Seth in the real life and distance her from being into that kind of guy, I see as the ethical thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. No, 100%. I agree.
Yeah. Sorry, not to kink shame, but in this instance, I think I actually am kink shaming. Don't do it. Don't be like Cameron.
But let's get to our discussion question answers, shall we? So our discussion question last week was, what's something that would make a terrible implement, domain, or familiar that you would still do the ritual with because you love it? And I think this is a great question and some great answers to this one. We all know the classic, don't make your mobile phone your implement advice.
Yeah.
But if you were going to do something like that, what would it be? It's a great question.
Yeah, and we did get Duonem submitted their smartphone or a Kindle.
Yep. Or a Kindle, yeah.
Yeah, which, yeah, do love. That would be terrible, but I can kind of, like, yeah, I can see it. You know, the amount of time I spend on my phone, like, there'd be a logic to it even with all the drawbacks.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons why it's a bad idea, but, in terms of the implement should be a thing that I spend a lot of time with, it makes a lot of sense.
I talk to people on my phone a lot more than I do in real life. I live a very hermit lifestyle. There's an argument to be made. It's a good representation for how I operate.
I love Belegtal's answer, which was, my cat's dumb and not another, but I want her to be my familiar. It's just like, yeah, I get it.
Yeah, that's a funny one. I would never. Ripper 1337 also brought the other textbook. Wilbo is confused why he keeps having to tell people this is a bad idea. One, they wanted the old RV domain.
Mm-hmm.
They said, yeah, it doesn't make sense because they can't even drive, which is just an extra question mark on top of this, which I love. But also,
way to avoid the downsides of the RV domain.
It's actually just a proper domain in an RV. But yeah, they said, you know, for their lifestyle, they need things like solid internet stuff. So it's a terrible idea, but they would love the freedom that you get with it.
Yeah, I think my favorite answer was Ace of Swords answer, which was the perpetual stew, which was a great answer because it both explained exactly why it's a terrible idea while also kind of selling me on the idea of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I understand because they pointed out like the thing with food is you use it to reinforce and nourish yourself.
Yes.
But consumable implements take from yourself to regenerate them.
Yes.
So the idea of having food as your implement is like dumb because presumably you're just losing stuff to like the inefficiency of energy transformation. So it's like, wait, absolute best case scenario for that implement is a net like zero change. But they brought up the perpetual stew as something that because you can keep adding ingredients to a stew, hopefully that mitigates it somewhat. I really liked this answer.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the perpetual stew was great. It made me think of having a never ending packet of Tim Tams as my implement, which is the Australian version. And yeah,
that's what we eat instead of stews. Tim Tams.
Tim Tams. Duh. No, yeah, I thought it was very good.
Yeah, sorry, I'm just gonna vent for a bit.
Okay,
we had Pavlova. We had Pavlova here, and I fucking hate Pavlova, and I don't get why everyone in Australia eats Pavlova for Christmas.
It's nice.
It's the worst dessert.
What? How can you not think it's? I mean, it's not, you know, in the same way as a lot of desserts, it's not something you would eat as like a meal, but as a just like a little dessert, sure.
No, like it's just. No, it's feral.
Well, it's just fruit and meringue. What's wrong with it?
I don't like meringue.
Well, okay.
The fruit is the best part.
Sure, but then you're not really against Pavlova. You're just saying you don't like meringue. It's like saying, tiramisu is the worst dessert because I don't like coffee. You know what I mean? Like, sure, fine.
I don't like tiramisu because it's got coffee in it.
Yeah, so that's not the fault of the dessert. It's just you don't like the taste of one of the ingredients.
But there's more to Pavlova than meringue because it's got that middle bit that's also just like gross. Like it's like the middle of a marshmallow slightly melted, which is like marshmallows are also another bottom tier.
That's the meringue bit, right? That's just the middle of the meringue, isn't it? Or is it a different thing?
I think it's technically different.
Really? Isn't that just like the less cooked bit of the meringue? I don't know.
Point is, meringue, marshmallow, whatever. I hate it. I don't know why everyone. It's just baffling to me that it's like the only Christmas dessert here in Australia, and it's so bottom tier.
Well, I don't think it's the only. It's a very iconically Australian. It's as iconically as Australian as a Lamington. But you know, we had tiramisu for our Christmas dessert and some like cookies and shit. So yeah,
I'm jealous. We just had Pavlova. Terrible.
Nah, Pavlova is nice. Anyway, what other answers did we get?
Ros Ray said, knowing me, I'd try some fucked up custom implementum ritual with Archives of Nethys, website.
A website that we all, of course, know very well.
Yes, but for those who don't, you know, if theoretically you were going to Google it, like I totally didn't have to. No, it's like a tabletop role-playing like Starfinder and Pathfinder, I think. Like, it's like where all the official rules for them are. It's like the official website of those, I think.
Mm.
So, yeah, like basically some bizarre implement ritual to tie you into the lore of tabletop RPGs, which I don't understand what that would look like. But I do think Ros Ray is right that it would probably be fucking weird and not that powerful, but it would certainly be unique and interesting.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Would be a good one, I think. Would be unique. Hey, let's talk about Hobo Demon's one, which I'm pretty sure is just a reference to Mystery Men. Do you know Mystery Men? Do you know that movie, Elliot?
No, I mean, I've met mysterious men in my life, but
okay,
I don't know.
Sure. Because it seems very overtly a reference to Mystery Men, but you didn't seem to put it in the notes. So I was like, okay. Anyway,
specifically, there was one of these that I didn't understand, which was the reference to Attack Hammer. And then there was one that I wish I didn't understand, which was that there was like a father's head in a resin bowling ball.
Yes, a bowling ball made out of their father's head. And then they go on to say that a shovel would be their choice of implement. So Mystery Men is this movie with like Ben Stiller and some other people. I forget who's in it. I'm trying to think.
Oh, it's got that guy we're talking about on The High Ground.
Oh, yeah, yeah. William H. Macy. But it's like a kind of,
he has been in more things than just Jurassic Park 3. You're right.
No, it's a movie that I think was kind of ahead of its time in the whole superhero deconstruction thing. It's about this gang of very shitty superheroes who have to like step up to save the day, including Janine Garofalo, whose power is that she has a kind of a magic bowling ball that she can use to bowl things, that's made of her father's head. But also one of the main characters, I think William H. Macy's character, maybe, I don't know, is the Shoveler, who's just a guy who has like superhuman abilities with a shovel, I think is what his power is. So he basically just fights with a shovel. Anyway, good movie. I don't know if it holds up. I have not seen it in a long time, but I remember enjoying it when I was younger.
It's always a risk with movies that you haven't seen that long ago, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Don't hold me to that, but I remember enjoying it when I was young. But yeah, so Hobo Demon's answer eventually is a shovel, as an implement of like laying foundations, digging, but also burying, like sign of hard work. Like, I think it's actually a pretty good implement.
I was kind of sold on it by the end, to be honest. I don't think it's that bad a choice. I think there's a lot of imagery to pull from there. It's a pretty well-recognized old tool.
Yeah.
Bowling ball is much more in line with what the spirit of this question was asking, I think. And then I the last answer I wanted to talk about today was from Prior Ad 9972. Who they suggested they do a fossil. They thought fossils are neat. And I like this as a transformation on like the rock implement, because I remember the rock came up in the implementum thing 16 arcs ago now, as like it's like a premier example of a shit implement is to have a rock.
Yeah.
And I think a fossil is the nice transformation on that, because it's probably still going to have most of the shittiness, but it's like, well, but it's a special rock. So yeah, I like that.
Yeah. No, I think it's a good way to make a rock a bit more exciting as well. I think it's good stuff. Were there any others that we missed? I think that's all of them.
Yeah, that's all the ones I'd written down. Yeah.
Yeah, perfect. Well, yeah, thanks everyone for leaving your answers to our discussion question. Of course, we have a new discussion question for this week, which is, what rituals and symbolisms would you put into your blood-based or other religion?
Yeah, because I'm kind of obsessed with Marisica's thing for her religion, where they put the three fingers over their mouth. And I'm doing it in real life at the moment, realizing that means nothing to anyone because I'm alone in this room.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's fun to... I'm curious what I would do, so I thought I'd be curious to hear what everyone else would do as well. Like, if you were an up-and-coming god like Marisica, what weird shit would you put into your religion?
Yeah, I like that. I like that as a discussion question. What's the weird symbol that you would put in? So do you think Marisica was a fan of the Hunger Games? Is that where this has come from, do you think?
Oh, I hadn't thought of that. Do they only use two fingers for that?
They do, but come on, it's pretty close.
Well, yeah, Marisica's actually setting herself up to be a sequel to the Hunger Games.
So yeah, you can leave your answers to that discussion question in our discussion thread, which you find linked in the show notes down below. And also, why not leave us a review on your podcatching platform of choice? This is a non-typical but great way to get people into Wild Bird stories.
People will listen to our first episode or our latest episode and I think, wow, this sounds really interesting. I'd better read this book.
Yeah. Why do you think I started this episode talking about what Pale is? So that people can get into it if they don't know.
Don't forget to check out our Twitter too. There's official lore lists and also memes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A new meme every day. So check that out on @PaleReflectCast. And of course, if you want to check out more stuff from the Doof Media Network, the best place to do that is the home of the network, doofmedia.com. It's a website that is dedicated to all the great podcasts on the Doof Media Network. So check it out and see what you find.
Yes. And then don't forget to stop by Wildbo's Patreon, patreon.com/Wildbo, or he'll come into your dreams and horrify you.
And yeah, with that, we'll see you next time, folks. Have a great holiday season.
Yes. Merry happy.
Merry happy.